This is the Startup CEO, a podcast for the innovators, the problem solvers, and the leaders of the next generation of business, giving you insights on how to be a successful startup CEO. With your hosts, Jeff Graham and Luke Fox.
Hello and welcome to the fourth and final episode in a series of four podcasts about how to be a successful startup CEO. I'm Luke Fox, the founder and CEO of White Fox, a global leader in drone security. Our speaker today is a personal mentor of mine who has helped many CEOs achieve successful companies. I'm honored to introduce Jeff Graham. Jeff has been himself a CEO in four different Silicon Valley startups over the past 20 years. Before that, Jeff was a senior executive in four publicly traded computer companies. Today, we are talking about managing your stakeholders and organizational structure. Jeff, can we start by you telling us a little bit about what you mean by stakeholders?
Sure, Luke. Well, when I say stakeholders, I'm talking about the various different entities that have a stake or interest in the success of the company. In previous podcast episodes, we talked extensively about employees, and they're a very important stakeholder, obviously. However, in this session, I'm going to talk about your partners that are also stakeholders. I'll start with investor partners, both board members and those not on the board. I'll also discuss partners like customers, channel partners, and partners like your lawyers and your bankers, and if you have them, auditors too.
Wow, a lot of stakeholders at the table. Well, I'd love to start off then with your advice on investors and how to best manage those.
Yeah, so just to talk about choosing an investor first, and then later on about how to manage the investors and managing your board of director investors. The first thing I think one has to remember is you'll be choosing both a venture capital firm and a specific venture capitalist in that firm who will most likely be on your board for several years. If you have the option, I'd always say choose a top VC firm over a smaller one. A small, less known one is not as good as a larger, well-known one. And do not fixate on valuation, and do not choose a VC on the basis of valuation. Incidentally, I believe terms are often more important than the valuation. The reason I say choose a top VC is very simple. You will find subsequent fundraising much easier. Remember, this is a process here, one fundraising after another over a period of years. Most investors, or at least the large investors, like to follow top VCs. The reverse is also true. If you start your investment with a small VC, you'll only be able to attract VCs that are small or smaller than the one you previously had. And this will make your subsequent fundraising rounds difficult. Also, it's worth bearing in mind that high valuations can bite you in the butt later on. If you do not achieve the goals you defined when you raised the last round, you may be forced into a down round valuation, and that can be devastating. So basically, choose a VC with the highest brand name recognition you can find, and an individual VC partner that you think you can work with.
Well, it's so counterintuitive to think that you don't necessarily want to raise money from the person offering you the highest valuation. And so as we take those deals and we bring people on to the board, can you tell us a little bit about board meetings and how frequent those should be? And what does that really look like in the logistics of the board meeting?
Well, if you have the title of chairman, and very often the founders are also the chairman, you will get to propose a number of board meetings. I suggest six. That would be one every quarter in the month after you close, in week two or three after the close. For example, if your fiscal year is the annual calendar, then your quarterly review board meetings are in the second, third week of January, April, July, and October. You should add then one more board meeting in the spring, let's say May, to discuss strategy, and one in the fall, say November, to review and approve next year's financial plan. Half a day is usually sufficient for board meetings, but they may grow to a full day as you get bigger. And I suggest you view the board meeting as a milestone for measuring your achievements and progress. If you're also chairman, you get to define the agenda, but it's important that you get prior agreement to that agenda with your investors. You should plan on the board meetings being 50% presentation and 50% discussions. Boards hate death by PowerPoint. They want to ask questions and they want to talk. And I suggest you split the board meetings 70% of the meeting with your executive team there and 30% of the meeting with just the board. Also, plan to meet your lead investors outside of board meetings too. Arrange some casual dinners. This will help you build your relationships and helps you understand their thinking in this casual environment. By the way, always provide food at board meetings. Often board members are running quickly between meetings and they will appreciate being fed. Even if nothing gets eaten, they'll appreciate it being there.
Everybody loves feeling taken care of and nobody likes working with someone who's hangry. That's a great point. I'm curious, what other advice do you have around board meetings and how to ensure they're really set up for success?
Well, you'll find often when you're a founder, then the VCs want monthly meetings to start with. But I'd suggest starting with the six, you know, scheduled board meetings. But it's important that you send a monthly email update regarding performance and goals. You'll get them comfortable if you're keeping them in the picture. If you have the choice as well, I would say do not allow observers to attend your board meetings. Now, I will say you might not get that choice, but observers are usually the least knowledgeable person about your technology and your business in the room. And so they force the discussion to have a framing preamble and to be simplified. And more importantly, they usually add no value to the board meeting. Let me be clear here. I don't mean you shouldn't talk to your non-board investors. Far from it, you really should. But what you should do is offer them some specifically quarterly meeting time. Go and see them in their offices and give them an update. So you can replace the need to come to a board meeting. Or if it's recorded, just send them a recording of it. And I have no problems sharing slides. It's the presence of more people in the room, I think, does not help board meetings.
That makes a lot of sense for board observers. What do you think about independent directors in the board meeting?
Yeah, I think it's very useful for a founding CEO to have one independent director on the board. You want to have someone who can be your mentor and coach and be your champion, really. You ideally need someone who's done your job before and has the knowledge of your market. That person needs to have the respect of the investors and bring sufficient credibility, of course, to the table. Once you've identified someone you want, then you need to have that person meet your other board members. Make your board feel like they are choosing the independent director. It's also worth remembering, as you approach the IPO process, of course, you'll need to add another independent director, and that will probably be a company, ex-company CFO, onto your board, and they will head up your audit committee into the IPO process. Let me add some other thoughts on investors and board meetings. Always be honest. Always disclose bad news. And always be optimistic. Never think you're irreplaceable. The way you keep your job is by beating your numbers, beating the goals you set, and keeping the board's confidence in you. You must try to avoid surprises at all costs.
What great advice in life in general, just avoiding surprises, keeping that communication flowing. So that makes sense for the board, but what about for customers and channel partners?
Well, let's start by thinking what a customer and a channel partner wants. They want a trusted partner. They want a predictable experience, things we've talked about a lot in prior podcasts. And they want to avoid risk. As a CEO, you need to build a personal relationship with a key decision maker in your largest customers and in your channel partners. Put those meetings in your calendar. If you plan them in, they can happen. Plan to meet them at least once a year, face-to-face, and then check in once a quarter by phone. As I said before in podcasts, challenging events and failures can be seen as opportunities, not problems, and should be seen that way, because they can often be the way you prove yourself to a customer or a channel partner in those tough times. So view them with relish, if you like, when they occur, and go overboard to ensure that the partner sees that they can rely upon you in the bad time.
Makes a lot of sense to really seize the opportunity as that to strengthen the relationship. So then moving on from channel partners and customers, how do you look at suppliers, lawyers, bankers, auditors, all these other stakeholders that that are so integral in the success of the company?
Well, the reality is you don't treat them any differently than you treat your employees. You get to know them, you let them know you, you meet them and you build a trusting relationship. One comment on auditors, you will need 3 years of audited financials if you go public. So you need to plan on that if that's your end goal. You don't have to have audited financials, of course, before that, but some early customers may demand audited financials from you. So it's not a bad idea to get that in process. And a lot of the large auditors will offer very cut price deals to just do your early audits and are not particularly more expensive than the smaller auditors.
That makes a lot of sense, especially as we look at all of these external auditors, so many people involved in the success of the company. But as we turn our focus into the company, what do you think about setting up the organizational structure? What functions do you think startups need, and when do you think startups need them?
Most early hires in a startup, as you know, Luke, are engineers, and the founder is usually the leader of the team. There may also be a co-founder in the organization too. You know, the first person you hire is some admin help to ensure the office is open, the AC works, there's food and drink available, and somebody to answer the phones and pick up the FedEx packages and so on. At this stage, in this early stage, outsource everything else: finance, PR, web services, HR, IT, legal help, and so on. Often, the founder's next hire is a business development guy, mainly because they think it's someone to handle all the outbound interests, and they kind of see BD as a catch-all function. But I think that's a mistake. I think the next hire outside of engineering should be a product manager. This individual will put order to the engineering feature schedule and will do the potential customer communication for you. After that, I'd hire a product marketeer, an outbound person, to manage your external agencies like the website and start building your customer communication messaging. This organization should be capable of proving out the founding concept and this initial value proposition that you've put together. Once you are ready to find your first customer, then you hire your first sales guy. All these folks should report to you, the founder. So de facto, now you're also the CEO. I personally prefer all these people to be in one location, but sometimes you've got to compromise and have them dispersed.
And so what I don't hear you talking about is hiring vice presidents or other executives.
Yeah. However, let's assume now you've proven out your technology and a customer's buying stuff from you. You then can start scaling. So this is the point you hire the VPs. A VP of sales, a VP of marketing would be helpful to bring in now at this point. As a founder, you're probably still leading the engineering team, of course, and may have appointed a couple of directors to do day-to-day management. You might also hire at this point a customer success or a support manager to work on installations and support. These three VPs can then do your build out, your scaling of your organization. Also at this point, you may want to hire a VP of engineering that will allow you to back off leading the engineering team and become a full-time CEO.
Okay, so as the company now is growing, who would you hire next after that? Is that a CFO, a head of HR? What really happens at that next stage of scaling?
No, neither, Luke. You don't need a CFO or a head of HR until a year before you go public. A controller might be helpful if you can't find a good partner in the outsourced finance world, or if you feel personally exposed in financial planning.
That's so counterintuitive, but makes a lot of sense. What other organizational advice around how you structure the internals of the company do you have?
Well, I think it's very clear to have clear job responsibilities. I often find in startups, job responsibilities are somewhat vague, but it's important to define them and who owns what. Your role as a CEO, of course, is the orchestrator of that team. And in reality, as an old boss at HP used to say to me, you manage the white space on the org chart. You make that work together.
It's often difficult to define what those job responsibilities are as the company's growing, but so critical. So when you look back on your career, just putting this all into context, what size of companies were you joining and building in these startups? Like what stage were they in? Just put this all really into perspective.
Sure. In all cases, I have been brought in by the lead venture capitalist. Often a new large investor, when they come in, they want an experienced, quote, professional manager like me, and they want that person brought into the company. The companies I've joined had all proven out their technology, or at least they thought they had. As I say, they thought they had, because sometimes you discover it wasn't quite well enough done. Employee-wise, they had 25 to 40 people typically and had just started selling the product. My job essentially was to scale the company, to hire the missing VPs or perhaps replace some. Sometimes I move the founders into CTO visionary roles or a visionary speaker. And in some cases, they left the firm. By the way, I always preferred to have the founder stay because they added the vision, they kept the vision going, and they added a vital energy that I think is very important. The only reason that anybody leaves a firm when I'm in charge is if they struggle to contribute or they're hurting the organization unity. The other role that was an important part of my job at that time was to raise additional money. And of course, that's what gives confidence to new investors, is somebody that they think, oh, I can rely upon that person. But my ultimate role, of course, was to create the exit, either getting the company to be acquired or doing an initial public offering.
So many diverse experiences there, and really makes sense how you can bring that all together to paint a clear roadmap for startup CEOs. I'm curious, any last thoughts to share?
Yeah, the role of a CEO in a startup is an exciting one, but you must be very self-reliant, which is one of the reasons that sometimes senior managers that come from public companies into startups don't succeed, because they're not used to being an individual contributor, as you need to be sometimes in a startup. You should not need any help doing your role. A lot of what you do is quite basic, hands-on stuff. You may like doing strategy at one end of the spectrum, but you also need to be willing to do the photocopies at the other end of the spectrum. This is the nature of this role. What I liked about it, the joy in the job, if you like, for me, is I was 100% applied to the success of the company. As Harry Truman said, the buck stops here.
And as the buck stops here, this is unfortunately the end of this of our series here, this four-part series. But this has just been extremely helpful. I know for me, hearing it from you, and I know for many CEOs out there that are on their journey. So some of the key things that I've heard that are recurring themes across all of these episodes, across all of this advice and wisdom you've shared, I just want to share some of those, make sure I'm hearing them right. And so does that work for you, Jeff?
Yeah.
Okay. So one is the importance of planning and preparation, the double P's there, planning and preparation. And then combined with that, ensuring that we're having a key focus on what it is that we're doing, measuring what that is, and prioritizing. Focus, measurement, prioritization. So, so critical. And then bringing that really home is having a clear value proposition, really making it clear what is this company doing and why does it exist? How does it help people? And then creating that market, having that clear value proposition and creating the market. And part of that that's so critical is, of course, knowing your customer. I heard you say that again and again, knowing your customer. Whether that's your literal customer or the employees, really knowing who that end user of what you're sharing and doing is. And in order to do that, you have to really understand the technical invention. How does this technology really work, and how does it transform what has been done before? And through all of that, this is where we then dove into the management style, which I loved, which was talking about trust, consistency, predictability, minimizing those surprises, really knowing that that management style is built on that foundation of trust, consistency, predictability, being a trusted partner of all the stakeholders around, and putting those processes and systems in place to create that trust, consistency, and predictability. And as you talked about so much in just this last episode, is managing our partners and building an organization over time, scaling it to grow to success, because that doesn't happen overnight. And finally, just think big. I heard you say it so many times. We have to really think big and expand our what exists today into the vast future that we are creating as a startup, because there's a reason we exist. Jeff, how'd I do? Was I a good listener?
I think you've summed it up very well. There are all the points I made. It's been a real pleasure to do this with you, Luke. Thank you so much.
Well, I really, really appreciate all of this wisdom that you've shared. And to all those listening out there, I hope you can join us throughout this entire series and to really take all of the key wisdom that Jeff has shared over his many decades of experience in both small companies, large companies, and scaling them from small to big, successful exits. So thank you so much for joining us on this episode of How to Become a Successful Startup CEO.